This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today, we're bringing you part 3 of Missing in the Keys, the story of two teenage girls who vanished from Marathon, Florida in 1974. Did they run away? Were they abducted? These are the burning questions of this investigation, but the answers are elusive, obscured by time.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
In parts 1 and 2, we learn more about 16-year-old Cindy Gooding and 12-year-old Terry Alfonso, and we've been retracing their last known movements. We've heard from several people, some who say they saw the girls or spoke with them on the night they went missing. If you haven't already, go back and listen to parts 1 and 2. And check out our show notes right now to help you follow along. Go to apbcoldcase.com. Now, all persons are presumed innocent. We're not alleging that any of the people we'll be talking about are official suspects or persons of interest. Picking up where we left off, Cindy Gooding's brother was telling me about the guy his sister was dating at the time of her disappearance.
Everybody called him Little Dave. He's kind of a nut job. He would buy a $200 car just so he could run it to death and flip it over and see how many times he could flip it. That kind of shit. I just knew he was about a little bit crazy. And I don't know how many years later it was, but my mom found out that Cindy was living with Dave or staying with Dave, and they had gotten to a big fight. And my mom was curious enough. She hired a private detective to run him down, and he actually found him. And he says, "How'd you find me out here?" That's all he wanted to know. He wouldn't tell the guy shit. But the only thing he would say to the guy, "How the hell did you find me?"
So Little Dave, or David, was interviewed by police in 2011. It's unclear, but that may have been the first time he was spoken to by authorities about the disappearance of Cindy and Terry. At the time of that interview, David was in his 60s and living in another state. He told detectives that he'd known Cindy for just about 8 weeks back in 1974, and that he saw her daily during that time. He said that she had a crush on him, but he denied that there was ever any relationship between them, though police expressed skepticism about his denial. David told detectives he worked different jobs back then, including as a commercial fisherman and as a prep cook at a resort in Marathon. According to police reports, David said the last time he saw Cindy was at an unnamed hotel in Marathon Shores where they used to hang out. He was in a room with her, but he left and went to the bar because she was asleep. About 45 minutes later, he said that his friends, a 16-year-old boy and the boy's father, came into the bar and told him that Cindy was still sleeping. David said he stayed at the bar for a couple hours, and when he went back to the room, Cindy was gone. And he said he was unaware that anything was wrong until 2 weeks later when her brother asked him if he'd seen her. Investigators asked David about 12-year-old Terry Alfonso. He said he did not know her and was unaware that she was also missing. The investigator asked David if he had any idea who could have abducted the girls. He offered up information about a guy he used to ride to work with when he was a prep cook at that resort in Marathon. He said that the guy drove a delivery van, but he couldn't remember his name. He thought maybe the guy had been arrested for killing a woman on Grassy Key. That statement certainly grabbed our attention, so we looked into it, but we didn't find anything about an arrest for murder on Grassy Key. Oddly enough, we will be talking about human remains found on Grassy Key, and that case is still unsolved. Again, getting back to Cindy's boyfriend, David, in their investigation, authorities dug a little deeper, trying to learn more about him. One witness police interviewed described him as a sex fiend who exhibited odd behaviors like jumping around and doing circus tricks. The report didn't elaborate on that, but David was cooperative with authorities. He answered their questions and voluntarily gave them a DNA sample. I've given you a lot of names in these first three episodes, so I want to remind you that there's a who's who in the show notes on our website. Now, we're going to go back to that hotel incident little Dave spoke about in his interview with investigators in 2011. His account had some similarities to a statement given to police in 1997 by Little Dave's 16-year-old friend. In the friend's account of events, he said the hotel in question was Indy's Inn on Duck Key, not a hotel in Marathon Shores. In the report, he goes on to say that all four of them, Little Dave, Cindy Gooding, himself, and his own father, all left Indy's Inn and went to the Jerrydale on 91st Street. If you remember, Terry Alfonso's sister, Darlene, had a unit there, and that's where the girls had been staying. But the story offered by Little Dave's friend doesn't give any specifics on which unit they were in or what date it occurred. The report went on to say that the next morning, Cindy was sleeping when the three men left to go to Miami. He said that was the last time he ever saw Cindy, and he believed she went missing sometime after this incident. He said he didn't know Terry Alfonso. He also said he was very close with Little Dave. Many people thought they were brothers, but his own brother didn't like Little Dave and didn't approve of their friendship. So let's talk about Indy's Inn. You can see the location on map number 2 in our show notes. Former Marathon resident Sharon remembered it.
Duck Key was a destination because there was a bar there called the Indy's Inn, and they always had a live band. So a lot of Marathon people would hitchhike up to Duck Key. It's about 15 minutes from Marathon going up north towards Miami. You know, that was like the big ticket. If you could get into a bar to see a live band, you know, that was the most excitement you could have down there.
Indy's Inn was a popular destination for tourists and locals alike. In the 70s, it was described as the best hotel in Marathon. And you might remember that Terry Alfonso's sister, Darlene, and her roommate worked at the Indy's Inn as maids. In fact, after our original interview with Darlene, she remembered that Cindy Gooding worked at Indy's for a short time, and that may have been where they'd first met. So here's where we are. We're unable to confirm what day the incident at Indy's Inn took place, or if the girls ever met up with Little Dave on the night they went missing. And we don't know if any of the witness accounts were ever corroborated by police. But even if every single sighting was confirmed and corroborated, the families are still no closer to an answer as to where the girls are now. But they're not giving up. After the disappearance, residents of Marathon were talking. Many thought the girls ran away, but then another potential lead surfaces. It has to do with a party that the girls were invited to. Cindy Gooding's sister, Diane, shared the story she heard from older brother Joe, who since passed away.
I remember him saying, I told him there was going to be a party that night at Grassy Key. I think it was more mentioned. That's the impression I got from Joe. You know, just letting you know that's what's going on tonight, if you feel like it. And she said, oh, all right, I will hitchhike there. Everyone hitchhiked. And apparently they went into the movies, what I have heard, with no intention of going in the movies. They just wanted to get dropped off, and that's where they could hitchhike from, is what I was led to believe. And from the way I got the impression from Joe, things could change. You know, hey, we'll hitchhike there. That doesn't mean if I don't show up, panic. It was the way people were then. Have fun. Do your thing. I think the next day when he realized, you know, I think that's when the kind of what's going on, you know, anybody seen them? And even then it wasn't a panic.
Joe told her that the girls never showed up. But in a contradictory report, Terry Alfonso's family were told that the girls were there. Bonnie, the sister of missing 12-year-old Terry, explains.
But her sister-in-law said that Cindy Gooding and Terry were at this party in Grassy Key, that she had seen them at that party.
The girl she's talking about is someone who claimed to be at the party, and she revealed this information to a relative on her deathbed, and the relative then shared the information with Bonnie years later. And this part's a bit vague, but information provided to the police by Terry Alfonso's family indicated it was the woman herself who reportedly said her husband may have had something to do with the disappearance of Terry and Cindy. We're not going to name them here since the information is at least third hand, but there does appear to be some sort of relationship between that woman's husband and Cindy's boyfriend, Little Dave.
she had kind of accused her husband, but that was all the crew that hung together, Little Dave and everything.
Bonnie told me that part of the information revealed to her had to do with a truck that the husband owned, which blew up in either February 1974 or February 1975. And if the implication is that the truck was destroyed in order to conceal evidence of a crime, February 74 was months before the girls disappeared, and the 1975 date would have been months afterward. But in a twist, when that witness is interviewed by police years later, she tells them she's confident that her husband was not involved. So back to Grassy Key. We asked local resident Patty Bercier if people partied there back in the 70s.
Yes, and they still do. There's like a little rock quarry, if that's the same area, but I don't know who owns it or if that name's tied to it all. That I don't know. But from what I understand, it's just, and it's still the same, and there's no buildings around it. It's just this huge quarry that they would, that's been dredged out. I mean, it's full of water, obviously, and just land around it, you know, and mangroves and just a bunch of wooded area, you know. So, but I've never actually been out there. I was one of the ones that was scared to go out there.
According to reports, the party that the girls were invited to was at Joey Hatton's place, a house on what used to be a remote property on Morton Street and number 8 on our map.
But it was kind of secluded. So you can step out back and holler all you want. There ain't nobody going to say nothing about it.
Cindy's brother thinks it would not have been a large party.
Their party would have been half a dozen people with drugs and this and that and the other.
Today, the property's been transformed into a multi-million dollar estate. The lead about the party was brought to the attention of police in 2010. The property had since changed hands after Joey Hatton had passed away. The new owner cooperated with police, who returned with cadaver dogs. K-9 team searched the property in October 2010, but found no signs of human remains. But that doesn't mean that the girls weren't at the party. So we have two witnesses, both deceased, one who said the girls were at the party, and another who said they weren't. Much like the van sightings we spoke about in previous episodes, are we talking about two parties occurring on different nights, or two accounts of the same party? I asked Terry Pease Cameron, the friend who saw the girls getting into a van heading north at 92nd Street, if she thought the girls could have been going to a party on Grassy Key.
And I said, that's probably why I didn't go, because it was so, you know, it was far enough away that it'd have been harder to get a ride home. But I always wondered about Grassy Key because there were like these dirt pits, and I always wondered, you know, if that's what had happened to them as they got out there and got killed and got buried out or something.
I asked Cindy Gooding's brother what he thought.
I do not think I know that she disappeared at Joey Adams' house at Grassy Key was her demise. That has to be, because and that girl on her dying bed saying that she'd seen Cindy there, and that's the last she's ever seen of her, period, point blank. Nobody's seen her since. You got me?
You'll hear more about Grassy Key in an upcoming episode. So let's recap. The girls went missing sometime between late August and early September 1974, and we've touched on several sightings. The mobile home trailer on 74th Street, the Marathon Movie Theater, the parking lot of the Idle Hour Lounge, getting into a windowless van on US 1 and 92nd Street heading north, and a party on Grassy Key. Any or all of these sightings could have been on the night they went missing, but there's no way to be 100% certain. So let's look into the possibilities of why they're gone. Did they run away? As we heard from little sister Diane, Cindy Gooding had run away at least a few times in the past, but those events seem to be tied to an uncomfortable situation at home in Virginia and a strained relationship with her stepfather. She was in Florida now, far away from him and his rules. She seemed to have a lot more freedom. In fact, when she disappeared, her dad and two oldest brothers were away on a fishing trip. So, what would be her motivation to run? Terry Pease Cameron doesn't believe there is any.
But Cindy didn't have any reason to run away. And, you know, she lived with her brother and her dad, I believe. Terry, I can understand, because it was pretty rough on her at home.
But Terry's family has never believed that she just took off. They've always felt in their hearts that something bad had to have happened. Terry's mom, Mercedes, told police that they all had a very close relationship, and there was no way that Terry would have left home without ever contacting any of her sisters. So, if the girls didn't run away, were they taken against their will? Like, maybe by the guy in the white van at the mobile home trailer? I asked Arlene about that possibility.
But, you know, after I thought about it, if those gentlemen were crazy or, you know, killers, I think they would have gone after Wren and my sister Cindy, because they hung out with them quite a few times, or Angela. You know, after I thought about that, I'm like, well, why would that happen? Because they were, my sister Cindy was, she was only 11 months older than me. Beautiful girl. And Wren was a beautiful girl. And Angela was a beautiful girl.
Cherie McMillan, who was working at the movie theater, agrees that a teenage girl might have been targeted, but she doesn't think it was Terry or Cindy. She suggests the theory that someone may have forced Terry to call the theater that night because they were really after Darlene, and that's why Terry was crying on the phone.
I think that they were trying to lure Darlene out. I think the target was really Darlene. They were wanting Darlene. And I really believe, I keep hearing her crying over the phone, there's something about Darlene, Darlene. And I really believe whoever she was wanting Darlene, and Terry just was in the way.
It's an interesting theory, to say the least, but we've seen no evidence to corroborate it. So let's move on, because there are several more theories as to what might have happened to the girls. And over the last 50 years, many names have come up in the investigation. Some are people who had a casual friendship or connection with either Cindy or Terry, and those tips resulted in routine interviews. Other names would require a deeper dive by police, and others still were just dangerous predators who were in or near the Keys at the time the girls went missing, and who needed to be seriously looked into. Two such people drew the attention of law enforcement. And this part of the story includes what you might call a confession to killing two girls in the Keys, and one of their names was Cindy. So around the same time that our girls went missing, a boy by the name of Paul Crone and his father, Oliver Crone, were known to be in the Florida Keys. But to really understand this story, we have to fast forward three decades, to when a 43-year-old Paul ran into some trouble in the Northwest for armed kidnapping. It's 2007 when Paul Crone, living in Oregon, reportedly threatens his girlfriend with a knife, and he won't let her leave. When deputies respond, Crone won't answer the door, and that results in a response by the SWAT team and hostage negotiators. But after a couple hours, Crone finally surrenders, and he's arrested for kidnapping. After the arrest, Crone's girlfriend turns over an audio tape to police. In it, Paul allegedly discusses killing two runaways in the Florida Keys when he was about 10 years old, which would have been around 1973. Now, that's close enough to the timeline of our girls going missing in 1974 to be of concern to authorities. This was very likely the lead that brought detectives to interview Paul Crone about the disappearance of Cindy Gooding and Terry Alfonso. And boy, did he have a story for police to unravel. Terry Alfonso's nephew-in-law, Kevin, researched the Crones.
The father's name is Oliver Crone. They moved around a lot. Apparently, they had a home between Illinois and Summerlin Key. Back then, I guess it was hitchhiking was just going on very much. And anyways, what had happened was in jail, when the son had said, I want to confess to something that my father did. As a kid, I witnessed this, and pretty gruesome but detail-orientated things that took place.
You just heard Kevin say that Paul Crone wanted to confess to some gruesome events he witnessed as a child. What was he talking about? Well, I want to warn you, his account is disturbing, and you'll probably never hear anything as horrific as what he described. According to police, Paul Crone claimed that in the 70s, his father, Oliver, picked up two young girls hitchhiking on US 1 in the Florida Keys. They were standing on the side of the road before the Bahia Honda Bridge, a now abandoned but iconic bridge located 18 miles south of Marathon. He recalled their names as Cynthia and Melissa, and they claimed to be runaways. Crone said the girls rode in the back of the truck driven by his father, heading north to a place called Pirate's Cove, which he claimed was north of the Isla Mirada way station, where he made Paul and the hitchhiker named Melissa get out of the truck. He said his father struck Melissa in the head with a hammer, then stomped on her face. And while the other girl began screaming, Crone said his father grabbed her and stomped on her face. Paul told police that Melissa was lying on the ground and the other girl begged him for help. But Paul said he couldn't help her, and she stopped moving after that. He went on to say that his father made him get a gray tarp from the truck. He described his father cutting open one of the girls and pulling her insides out, stuffing her body with rocks. Paul claimed that his father made him assist in eviscerating the second girl before rolling both bodies in tarps and putting them into the water. And Paul said that eyeglasses had fallen off one of the victims.
And the description of those two girls matched Cynthia and Terry almost to a T. Kind of eerie. He'd also mentioned that it wasn't the first time that he had done these type of things.
As I said, Paul Crone's recollection of the girls' names at the time was Cynthia and Melissa. Was he talking about our girls? Could he have misremembered the names? Or is the whole horrific story made up? Well, while Paul was in jail, his girlfriend wanted to find out more about his confession. So she took to the internet and found the case of Cindy Gooding and Terry Alfonso. We didn't find any reports that she had shared this information with Paul, but it was after her search that Paul began claiming that the girls he and his father had murdered were named Cindy and Terry rather than Cynthia and Melissa, and that it occurred in 1974 rather than 1976 as he'd previously claimed.
It's been a few years even since this took place. This guy was deemed to be absolutely crazy. He's basically insane. And his girlfriend at the time, whom they questioned, who was around when these things were said, had basically, he was looking for attention, in other words. And then this guy, to be completely honest with you, the father was getting older. And so the worry was, we're not going to be able to question this guy because he's as old as he was and still living in Summerlin Key, still had a home in Summerlin Key at that time. And a home still in Illinois. So he owned both properties still. I don't know if he's still alive today. I don't have any knowledge of that.
Was any part of the story told by Paul Crone accurate or truthful? One detective said he wasn't sure if Paul had fabricated the story. So police set out on a fact-finding mission to see what, if any, part of Paul Crone's statement could be verified. Let's take a look at their timeline for the Crones. In May of 1974, about 4 months before our girls go missing, Paul Crone's father, Oliver, was released from jail after serving time for a sex crime. His residence was listed as Avon Park, Florida, about 270 miles from Marathon. But he was known to travel to and from the Keys selling fruit. Paul claimed he went to live with his father in 1974 and that they lived on Big Coppet Key, 39 miles south of Marathon. Detectives continued their work. They looked at the details of his statements, but his geographical descriptions did not match the actual locations. Detectives found that Paul Crone's physical description of the two victims also matched another case, that of Maggie and Mary Jenkins, two sisters from New Jersey last seen hitchhiking just outside of Key West, and whose bodies were found in a remote wooded area of Key Largo in May 1973. From our research, it appears that the Jenkins case is still unsolved. Police didn't find any solid evidence linking the Crones to the disappearance of Cindy and Terry. Was Paul Crone's story unraveling? And why would he implicate himself in the brutal murder of two young women? The one detail of his story that may have held some relevance was his comment about the pair of eyeglasses worn by one of the victims. Detectives said that Cindy Gooding did wear reading glasses. But as they dissect Paul Crone's elaborate story, much of it seems to be falling apart. At one point, Crone even claimed that he'd played board games with Ted Bundy while in prison. And while we're on the subject of Ted Bundy, you might be wondering if he was in Florida in the summer of 1974. Let's take a look at his murderous timeline. And while he did sexually assault and kill young women in several states, including Florida, between 1974 and 1978, Bundy was known to be living in Washington State and Utah when our girls went missing. He would ultimately confess to 30 murders, but he suspected in hundreds more. Strangely, Paul Crone believed that his own father killed more people than Bundy. Detectives couldn't verify whether Crone was ever in fact in the same institution as Bundy, but much of Crone's story seems to be an elaborate fabrication, a hybrid of many different pieces that ultimately fell apart. Police did interview Paul's father, Oliver Crone, as part of their investigation into the disappearance of Cindy and Terry. Detectives didn't mention any suspicion that they could have been kidnapped or murdered, yet Crone brought up a serial killer and another person who murdered victims in the area of Big Pine Key. He denied picking up hitchhikers, although he did admit to picking up a woman in the Everglades. This would have been during a period of time when his son was known to be with him. The elder Crone also mentioned to detectives that he recalled picking up Eileen Wuornos, one of America's most notorious female serial killers, saying he gave her a ride to a house on Little Torch Key, 20 miles from Marathon. He said he didn't know who she was until he read headlines about the murder she'd committed. It's interesting. Father and son each claim a connection to an infamous serial killer. Are they looking for some sort of notoriety? Police explored the Crones extensively, but in the end, seemed to have eliminated them based on statements from family members saying that Paul was not living with his father during the time our girls disappeared. The timeline's important in evaluating leads. It can help to include or exclude persons of interest. Could one of those relatives be mistaken? Could Paul have visited his father during that time frame? It's food for thought, but let's move on because another lead surfaces that might fit better into our timeline. In 1997, police re-interviewed one of Cindy Gooding's brothers. In that interview, he told police that Cindy was a very social girl and she liked to party. At the time, he also believed that Cindy had some sort of association with the infamous Outlaw Motorcycle Gang. We don't know what kind of association that was, or if it was a rumor he'd heard somewhere, or if he knew it for a fact, but if true, it's not good news. The Outlaw Motorcycle Gang's motto is, "God forgives, outlaws don't." And an online search reveals stories of some unspeakably vicious crimes, which we won't delve into here, but needless to say, these guys were not to be trifled with. So let's take a look at the possible connection, and specifically, some gang members who were in the Keys at the time of the girls' disappearance. Kevin, who we heard from earlier, has been a tireless researcher for the family, and during his search for information, he came upon an interesting report about a member of the Outlaws.
Now, let me tell you, this guy is documented as a very bad guy. And how I stumbled upon his name to begin with, I'll tell you, through doing some research. I checked the Monroe County libraries to do some research on what type of crime was occurring during the time that they went missing.
Kevin discovered that members of the Outlaw Motorcycle Gang were confirmed to be in the Keys in 1974. In fact, if you take a look at our timeline, there's some dates that are very concerning. According to reports, a known outlaw gang member by the name of James Walter Sterrett, also known as Blue, was in jail in the Florida Keys in April 1974. Then, in July, about 1 month before the girls went missing, he somehow managed to unlock his leg irons and escape from custody at a hospital about 50 miles south of Marathon in Key West. Monroe County Sheriff's deputies believed, but never proved, that someone may have smuggled the key into Sterrett, and they noted that he did have two visitors shortly before his escape. One of them, his half-brother, James Big Jim Nolan, who also just happened to be the leader of the Outlaws. So, Sterrett was now on the lam. Was he hiding out in the Keys? Or more specifically, in Marathon? Former residents Barb and Sharon.
there were a lot of misfits from other parts of the world that would come to the Keys to just escape life.
It was way down out of the way. If you were trying to get lost, it was a place to go because nobody could ever find you down there.
As young teens in Marathon, Sharon and Barb met their fair share of scary people trying to get lost.
I remember there was two guys that lived on a sailboat right at the fishing dock because it was very cheap to just rent a little dock space where you could park your sailboat. And they were always trying to get us to go to their sailboat.
And these were older guys. I had absolutely no fear at all. But those two guys always gave me the creeps. They could slip in, slip out, you never see them again. There were people that were just running away from life. You could escape to the Keys. No one knew who you were. No one really cared who you were, you know?
So it was possible that Sterrett was holed up somewhere in the Keys. And then on September 4th, 1974, just one day after Terry and Cindy are reported missing, an associate of his named John Earl Smith also escaped custody, this time from Big Pine Road Prison, 20 miles south of Marathon. Some reports indicate that Sterrett may have assisted Smith in his escape. Was the tip about Cindy Gooding having some association with the outlaws correct? And did she know James Walter Sterrett?
In those years, Sterrett had a van. And that van was a white panel van.
Coming up in part 4 of Missing in the Keys, Cindy and Terry have vanished, and there's quite a few dangerous individuals hanging around the Keys. Did they run into the wrong one?
He started telling me stories, scary stories, about how they would kidnap young girls, and he was part of the outlaw motorcycle gang.
Are we honing in on a killer?
They found the knife in the backyard where you'd hang up clothes. And then they said they found her panties in the lagoon, which was right down the road.
That's coming up in part 4 of Missing in the Keys. If you or anyone you know has information about the disappearance of 12-year-old Terry Alfonso or 16-year-old Cindy Gooding from Marathon, Florida in 1974, you can call Crime Stoppers anonymously at 866-471-TIPS or go to crimestoppers305.com or call 1-800-THE-LOST. Don't forget to check out our show notes for photos of Cindy and Terry, including age-progressed images, and for historical photos of Marathon, a who's who of the people mentioned in this episode, a timeline, maps, and more.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.